Appreciate the opportunity to be here with everyone this morning at the Men's Development Conference of BCS Church of Christ. I'm especially excited for the opportunity to be a part of the Texas School of Preaching coming on board. I've done a little bit kind of covering for Brother Rollo this past, at the end of this last year in restoration history. My family and I moved, we got moved in last week. And by moved in, I mean all the boxes are in the house and we have a pathway through the boxes and we're looking for this, that, and other. But the dust will settle. Looking forward to the beginning of the school year, getting into teaching, getting to know the students, and kind of getting my feet down and putting down roots. Our topic for this hour, a history topic, Josephus, eyewitness confirmation of the fulfillment of Matthew 24, 1 through 35. Now, if you're looking for a digital copy of this, I haven't got that turned in yet. I make no excuses. I'll just apologize, but I will get that turned in and get that uploaded. You know, I am always thankful for explanations of difficult passages or figurative language. Have you ever, after reading through a particular passage, felt like the Ethiopian eunuch? And someone saying, hey, did you understand that? And you say, nope, I didn't understand that. I wish I had someone who could help me better to understand that. Well, we have explanations of various texts in Scripture. You know, it's often said the Bible is its own best commentary. You know, we see this with parables. Parable of the sower, the apostles, the disciples, well, you know, what's the meaning of this? Jesus gives an explanation of that. In fact, Luke chapter 8, verse 11, now the parable is this. Same with the parable of the tares, both of those recorded for us in Matthew chapter 13. Some explanations are simple statements of parables. Luke chapter 18, 9 through 14, the parable of the Pharisee and the publican. Well, here's the point, here's the lesson. This man went down to his house justified, the one who humbled himself. And so there's no question with regards to particular matters of those parables. It's similar whenever we consider prophecies and their fulfillment. In fact, we're unaware when we read the Old Testament, sometimes we are unaware that certain events or statements are even prophetic until we come to the New Testament. Hosea chapter 11 and verse 1, I've called my son out of Egypt. We have no idea that that is a prophetic statement referring to the Christ coming out of Egypt, except for the fact that it's recorded for us in the book of Matthew. Isaiah's prophecy, Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 14, a virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son, thou shalt call his name Emmanuel. Well, we know this; these things took place that it might be fulfilled, Matthew chapter 1, 26, rather 22 and 23. Acts chapter 2 and verse 16, giving an explanation for what was taking place on the day of Pentecost. What did Peter say? This is that. You know, when an inspired apostle says this is that, then that's it. We know. We're not left in question. You say, well, why are you talking about all this? The writings of Flavius Josephus, as he is known to us today, have come down to us, and they serve as both an uninspired and I would even say unintentional explanation, a record, an eyewitness of the prophecy of Jesus Christ recorded for us in Matthew chapter 24 and also Luke chapter 21 with regards to the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, why do we have the writings of Josephus? How many ancient historians, Roman historians, how many of their writings, how many of historians are there? You know, I just did a quick search online for a list of some of these historians. Here's just a, here's a very, very brief list. There's Tacitus, Suetonius, Livy, Cassius, Dio, Julius, Caesar, Pliny the Elder, Pliny the Younger. We go on and on and on and on. Reputable, notable Roman historians who recorded their time and times before them. How many notable Jewish historians are there? You know, we have Josephus. And there is not another notable Jewish historian until we come to the 1940s. And so I scratch my head and I wonder, why is it the case that we don't have, now we have certainly the inspired record, but why do we not have notable historians, Jewish historians? Well, perhaps And this goes back to the discussion of providence yesterday, right? We'll say, perhaps it is the case that we have the writings of Josephus. They have come down to us providentially as an uninspired eyewitness account of the fulfillment of the prophecies of Jesus Christ. Our purpose for this hour, at least the way I'm approaching this lesson, is to consider Josephus as this and his eyewitness account that we have recorded for us in the wars of the Jews, and relate as much as time will allow us the fulfillment of the prophecy. We'll parallel the record of Josephus and the prophecy of Jesus Christ in Matthew chapter 24. Now, what I want to do to get us to that point, I first of all want to introduce just a short sketch of Josephus, who Josephus is. Many of us, perhaps most of us, maybe all of us are familiar with who Josephus is, but we're going to consider him. Then I'll give just a very brief outline of our text, Matthew 24, 1 through 35, just as I have it for this particular study. And then we'll note some of the words of Josephus as they provide for us an eyewitness account, not simply of and not necessarily the destruction of Jerusalem, but of those things that led up to it. To me, that's the more interesting, those events that led up to it. So with that being said, let's consider, first of all, who was Josephus? Well, Josephus was a Jewish historian. He was born in the first year of the reign of the Emperor Caligula, so about the year 37. He was of priestly lineage. Brother Epifanio spoke of the Hasmonean dynasty and the Maccabean revolt. Well, Josephus was a descendant of Mattathias, who was the instigator of that Maccabean revolt in 167 B.C. Josephus' father's name was Matthias. He claims in his history that he also is of royal descent. He had royal blood through his mother. His mother's not mentioned. So he is one who has a priestly descent, but also with royal blood. Okay? At the age of 16, he began to study the Jewish sects. In fact, he just began to study just religion as a whole, kind of went on what today someone would call his spiritual journey. And after considering the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, he chose to associate himself with the Pharisees. And so he is known as one who is a Pharisee. About the age of 26, he made a trip to Rome. Now, I find, we'll throw this in there, this at the age of 26, this is going to be about the time that Paul is in prison in Rome, okay, at this particular time. Well, he makes a trip to Rome also, but he's going on behalf of some priests who had been put in prison in Rome. He either has a contact or he befriends someone, a Jew who is an actor in Rome, and that actor is a friend, has an association with Poppaea, who was the wife of Nero at that particular time, and he has that connection. Poppaea befriends Josephus, and through that relationship and her influence, he is able then to effect the release of these priests in Rome. He stays in Rome for a couple of years. He returns about the year 65 to Judea. And there he sees an environment. He discovers an environment of rebellion. He sees these seeds of revolt. But he's been 2 years. He already knows of Rome. He already knows of the power of Rome. But he's been 2 years in Rome and now has that firsthand knowledge and that experience of seeing the majesty of Rome and the power of Rome. And he does all that he can to dissuade his fellow Jews to forget war, forget revolt. We need to lay down arms and we need to seek for peace. Well, he was unsuccessful. Ultimately, he takes a stand with the Jews, though he never really fully engaged with the Zealots. He never really was a part of that group. In fact, when you read the writings of Josephus in the wars, he'll refer to them as the seditious. He even refers to them as the robbers, whereas he'll refer to some as the men of power. That would be the high priest and those of the high priest, and that would be the Jewish elite who really wanted peace, but the zealots kept continuing to instigate rebellion. Well, Josephus, he cited as one who was loyal to the Jews. He ultimately stands with the people. He's given a command over Galilee. He begins to build up the strongholds that have been weakened. One of the cities in particular was a city called Jotapata, at which city he ultimately was taken captive by the Romans about the year 67. And so now Josephus is in custody of Vespasian, the general who has been handpicked by Nero after he'd been cast out by Nero, brought back in because nobody else could do the job. And so he is in custody of Vespasian. But Josephus, if nothing else, was a talker. And he tells Vespasian, "You and your son, Titus, who is also a part of the Roman armies there, a general, you and your son both will one day be emperors of Rome." Well, Vespasian, true to his Roman roots, and, you know, hey, this may be a man who's a prophet, and so we're going to listen to him. Rather than send him on to Rome to stand before Nero, he holds on to Josephus. And in a short period of time, hearing of Vitellius being put to death and his armies declaring him to be the emperor, well, then Josephus is set free at that particular time. Now, just a little bit to give you some idea of family of Josephus. About this same time, he marries one of the captives. Very shortly, in about a year's time, he'll divorce her and marry a woman from Alexandria, Egypt. And then he'll have one son by her. Hyrcanus, I believe, was his name. In about 5 years, he'll divorce her, marry a Jewess from Crete. They have two sons. And so three wives, three sons by the last two wives. But having been set free, Josephus doesn't say, "Well, you know, I'm leaving. I'm going to, you know, move to another place." He stays in the company of Titus and for all practical purposes becomes a diplomat, on behalf of Rome. He's not a traitor. Some people might refer to him as a traitor. He's really someone who loves his country, and he doesn't want to see his country destroyed. He doesn't want to see his people destroyed. He certainly doesn't want to see Jerusalem destroyed or the temple destroyed. He's of a priestly lineage, but he can't convince them. And so, ultimately, Jerusalem is destroyed. The temple is destroyed. Josephus, after the war is over, will travel to Rome. He will become a Roman citizen. In fact, Vespasian will commission him to write a history of the war, and he does. We have a record of that. And then he'll spend his later life as a writer, which we have four works from Josephus. I'll note those shortly. And an advisor to some of the Roman elite. As far as the writings of Josephus, the Wars of the Jews, written about the year 78, according to the scholars, it's a history of the Jews from the time of Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, mentioned yesterday, to about the year 66, or the fall of Masada, which would have been more about 73. Antiquities of the Jews suggested that it was published about the year 93. It's a history of the Jews from the creation, that to the year 66. An inspired account, certainly. But the account that Josephus provides. Sometime in the years 94 to 99, he writes his autobiography. So we have the life of Josephus. And then sometime after the year 94, it's suggested that Josephus died in the year 100 in the city of Rome. We have no record of the cause of death, perhaps natural causes. But sometime after the year 94, he writes a defense of the Jews, a defense of Judaism, titled Against Apion, who was a Greco-Egyptian speaker, scholar, who had criticized the Jews and the Jewish state. And so he writes a defense of the Jews. Well, this is just a brief sketch of Josephus, this man who we're calling an uninspired and unintentional eyewitness of the prophecies, the fulfillment of the prophecies of Jesus. Let's open our Bibles to Matthew chapter 24. Now, let me say this. My purpose is not to give explanation of any of the figurative language or difficult passages here. It's not to try to draw distinction between the prophecies concerning the destruction of Jerusalem and the prophecy of Christ's return and final judgment. I would suppose that the overwhelming majority of us are able to discern those things ourselves. My goal and my purpose for our time is to lay side by side some of the words of Josephus from the wars of the Jews and the prophecies of Jesus to give us the historical context, the historical fulfillment of these things as Josephus wrote them down for us, and then and parallel that to the words of Christ. Okay, that's going to be our goal. Now, just as for this particular study, just a brief outline that I put together to kind of help me with this particular session, an outline of Matthew 24, 1 through 35. Verses 1 and 2 I call an incredible statement, an incredible statement. And that is the disciples, and Mark tells us that it's Peter and James and John and Andrew, they are talking about the splendor of the temple. And, you know, the temple mount would hold anywhere between 70,000 to 100,000 people. It was certainly, an incredible, work of architecture. Jesus says not one stone will be left unturned. Now that's an incredible statement. And I would suppose that perhaps in the minds of those disciples, the only thing that could bring about the overthrow, the destruction of such a magnificent building that was a building in which God is honored and glorified, would have to be the end of the world. And so they then inquire, you know, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming? So we have in verses 1 and 2 the incredible statement. We have in verse 3 inquiring disciples. They want some explanation to this. You know, we started out, we need some explanation on some of these sometimes. Verses 4 through 8, the beginning of sorrows. And that's where we'll begin when we lay Josephus next to these prophecies. We'll start there at verse 4. The beginning of sorrows, and then verses 9 through 14, I refer to as the time of sorrows. Verse 9, we see the death of the saints. Verse 10, offense and betrayal. Verses 11 and 12, false teachers and falling away. Verses 13 and 14, endurance and evangelism. Now, most of that, those words we have record of in the Scriptures. So we won't spend much time on that. Verses 15 through 22, abomination of desolation. Daniel speaks twice of the abomination that makes desolate in Daniel. And we'll note that when we get there. Verses 23 through 26, the false Christ. The false Christ, I have in parentheses, false hopes of deliverance. We understand that whenever the Jews of that time, perhaps same as the mindset of many today, whenever they thought of the Messiah, it was a political saving, a political salvation, a political restoration. That's what they were looking for. Well, these false Christs provided false hopes of deliverance. Then verses 27 through 31, the true Christ. Here we see Rome actually coming in destruction. And so I refer to 27 through 21 as the true Christ. And in parentheses, the true Christ will come in judgment, not deliverance. That's what they will see. And then verses 32 through 34, the admonition. The admonition. In other words, you have been warned, be prepared. That's in essence what Jesus says. And then verse 35, heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away. The certainty. The certainty. Now, with that brief outline, I want to begin at verse 4 and talk about the beginning of sorrows. I'll read this. We won't necessarily read every section from the Scriptures, but I do want to read this to get us started. Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ. We will talk more about false Christ in 23 through 26, and shall deceive many, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. And that's where I really want to spend much of our time here in this section, wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. The end of Jerusalem is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. Well, let's look at some of the words of Josephus, his record, with regards to this wars and rumors of wars. Well, there were wars among the Jews. You had the rebellious, you had the seditious, you had the robbers, and then you had the men of power, the elite, and those who did not want rebellion. But it was instigated and it was forced through those who were very zealous. I want to introduce you to a man named Gessius Florus. We'll call him Florus. Florus was an agitator of Jewish rebellion. All right, who is Florus? Well, after Felix, and we're going to be able to draw some lines to the biblical timeline. After Felix, a man by the name of Albinus, was appointed as procurator of Judea. So it's going to be about between 62 to 64 in this time. Okay, this is according to Wars of the Jews in book 2, chapter 14. Josephus records this of Albinus. Now I say this because you need to understand Florus, what type of man he was. And understand this. Here's what would happen. If the Jews go to Rome and they speak about Florus, his governance is no good. He is not helping to support Rome. He's going to cause rebellion. He's going to cause an uprising. Well, what's the emperor going to do? I need to send somebody. I need to call Florus in, and I need to talk to him and see what's going on. So Florus is going to be doing all that he can to instigate rebellion, to make it look as if anything the Jews might accuse him of, which they will to the governor of Syria, is all false. They're the ones who are trying to instigate everything. Now, that being said, here's what Josephus says about Albinus, who was the procurator before Florus. Okay? Nor was there any sort of wickedness that could be named, but that he had a hand in it. If there's anything that's underhanded, that's fraudulent, well, Albinus had a hand in it. And he lists some. He would steal and plunder the treasures of individuals. He levied burdensome taxes on the nation. He accepted bribes to allow criminals to go free. In fact, Josephus indicated that the only ones in prison were the ones who didn't have enough money to pay, a bribe to get out of prison. Now, that's Albinus. But now listen to what Josephus says. Here's a summary. I think this is important. Josephus sums up the attitude among the Jews under Albinus. At this time were those seeds sown which brought the city to destruction. Okay, now this is just after the time of Felix. And so the seeds are being sown by the heavy hand of these Roman governors. Now, that's enough of Albinus. Notice what he says of Florus. Yet did Gessius Florus, who succeeded him, that is Albinus, demonstrate him, Albinus, to have been a most excellent person upon the comparison. So as bad as Albinus was, Florus was 10 times worse. He was 100 times worse. And when the people appealed to Cestius Gallus, who was governor of the province of Syria, Florus then approached him and said, he convinces him through false statements, everything the Jews are saying is false. Listen, I'm doing a good job. You need to listen to me. And he convinces him, well, this is all the Jews. And he does all this, obviously, to hinder charges against him from reaching Rome. And so what he does then, Florus does, he increases the calamities, any calamities that he can, upon the Jews, simply to try to incite this attitude of rebellion. Okay? So that's where we are. King Agrippa. We recall King Agrippa, Acts chapter 25, 26. He comes with his sister, Bernice, to hear he comes in a visit and he hears the Apostle Paul speak. King Agrippa actively worked to repress Jewish rebellion. In fact, all of those in a place of influence and position at that time did, except for Florus. He was doing everything to undermine. Now, I want to read is a rather long quote from the Wars of the Jews. It's in Book 2, Chapter 16. And this is a statement of Agrippa, okay? Speaking to the Jews, he said, "You are the only people who think it is a disgrace to be servants to those to whom all the world have submitted." You're the only ones who think it's a disgrace to submit to Rome. What's wrong with you people, okay? "What sort of army do you rely on? What do you have to back you, okay? What are the arms you depend on? Where is your fleet? What type of a fleet do you have to seize the waters? Where is your fleet that may seize upon the Roman seas?" Look at that. Rome not only controlled the land, Rome had the sea, the Mediterranean belonged to Rome. Where are your ships? Okay? "And where are those treasures which may be sufficient for your under-" How are you going to afford this? How are you going to pay for this? If you're going to bring people in, where's the money to pay for? You don't have that. "Do you suppose, I pray you, that you are to make war with the Egyptians and with the Arabians?" Oh, maybe you could sustain yourself against the Egyptians. Maybe you could sustain yourself against the Arabians, but watch this. "Will you not carefully reflect upon the Roman Empire?" You need to take time and look in the mirror. You need to back up. What did Jesus say? That a king, before he went to war, what should he do? This is what Agrippa's saying. You boys need to back up and see what's going on. You're fixing, and my daddy would say, you're fixing to bite off more than you can chew, getting up against Rome. "Will you not carefully reflect upon the Roman Empire? Will you not estimate your own weakness? Hath not your army been often beaten, even by your neighboring nations?" You can't even take care of the people next door. How are you going to deal with Rome? "While the power of the Romans is invincible in all parts of the inhabitable earth." He will go on to say that there are some places where there are thousands upon thousands of citizens and just a handful of Roman soldiers and a governor there to keep things at peace. And nobody else is rebelling. Now, watch this. "What remains," this is Agrippa, "what remains therefore is this." Here's the only hope you have. "What remains therefore is this, that you have recourse to divine assistance." The only hope you have is your God. That's it. But now what's this? "But this is already on the side of the Romans." Your God's on the side of the Romans. "For it is impossible that so vast an empire should be settled without God's providence." Well, Agrippa and others, leaders in the area, they worked, they tried to do everything they could to prevent the rebellion. Nevertheless, some of the seditious assaulted Masada, took it. Eleazar, who was the son of Ananias the high priest, Ananias the high priest was in opposition to the rebellion. Eleazar was in sympathy to the rebellion. And so he persuaded many of the priests, that is, Eleazar persuaded many of the priests, to receive no gift or sacrifice for any foreigner. What does the Apostle Paul instruct us, 1 Timothy chapter 2? For whom are we to pray? Rulers of the nation, of our nation and nations throughout the world. Is the ruler of our, rulers, are the legislators, are the leaders of our own nation, are they Christians? No, but we should pray for peace, so that we can live peaceful lives, that the gospel will have an open door to go forward. Well, this was a similar practice, and this was an ancient practice. This was a custom. But Eleazar convinces it. Now, here's something else. Under the Roman boot, hey, we're good with you worshiping your God as long as you sacrifice, you know, for peace for us. As long as you don't go to your God and try to instigate him against us. Okay? Rome would accept you. He would give you some liberty. They would give you liberties. But Eleazar says, no sacrifices for foreigners, so no sacrifices for Rome, no sacrifices for the emperor. Seeking to stop the rebellion, the men of power, Josephus says. Well, Ananias, the high priest, and the elites among the Jews, they conferred with the high priest and determined to send ambassadors to local kings. And so other provinces, other regions, for assistance. But the seditious, here's the quote, "But the seditious were strong and withstood, and there was perpetual slaughter on both sides for 7 days." Wars and rumors of wars. And I'll say that over and over. Perpetual slaughter for 7 days. Okay? Well, all what's going on, all this is going to go around, what's taking place. Then there's the siege of the Antonia Fortress. On the northwest corner of the Temple Mount was the Castle of Antonia, or the Antonia Fortress. It was a fortress. It was a barracks that would hold about 1,000 Roman soldiers. It was built by Herod when he had the Temple Mount built. He named it after Mark Antony. You know, Herod the Great, whenever Octavius, who would come to be known as Augustus, was going against Mark Antony, who lost. You know who Herod went for? You know who he supported? Antony. And whenever Antony lost, you know what Herod did? He appeals to, he goes to Rome. And he appeals to Octavius. And he says, you know, I never was for Antony. You know where my loyalty is? My loyalty is for Rome. I was supporting Rome. I wasn't supporting Antony. And I'll support Rome still with you. And you know what, Augustus, I don't really have time to deal with Judea anyway. Okay. And so he puts him in place. Well, the Castle of Antonia, this barracks from which soldiers run down in the book of Acts to save Paul from being ripped apart. Well, it was besieged and was razed. The garrison was taken. The citadel was set on fire. And then a man by the name of Menahem became the leader of the sedition for a period of time. Now, we're going to see some different names of different people. Some had great success. We're going to see that one particular Roman general, when he comes down and he has Jerusalem, all he's got to do is go knock on the door and they'll let him in. He can take it. But he, because of false information, perhaps that's what Josephus suggests, he leaves. And as he's in his retreat, the Jews of the sedition, they just come after. And rather than take all of the effects of war and put them in the middle as they're moving away, they keep them at the back. And some of them they just leave behind. And so the Jews just take them up. And now they've got weaponry. Okay? And we're going to find different men had success. I suggest to you that perhaps, I'll say that again, perhaps it is the case that some of these men were looked to from time to time as this Christ. Hey, we've got a man here who has risen up and he's successful. In John chapter 6, what is it, verse 15? Jesus, when he perceived that they would make him a king by force, what did he do? Why, answer me this, why in the world would the Jews want to make Jesus their king? What could he have done for them as a political king? What had he been doing? Somebody read for me Matthew chapter 17, I believe it's verse 11. Let me look, see. I may be off on the wrong chapter. It might be Matthew chapter 11. Give me a second here. Matthew chapter 11. Is it 7? It's when two disciples from John the Baptist are sent. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 5. Somebody read that for me. And remember, the Jews are looking for a king, okay? Somebody, Matthew 11, 5. All right, look at the miraculous things taking place. Man, the blind see. Any disease is cured. But look at that last one, the miraculous things. The dead are raised up. Man, we've got an undefeatable army here. Man, we go up against the Romans. It doesn't matter how strong they are. Look what this man can do. I'll run into battle, and if I lose my life, it's okay, because King Jesus will come, and he'll just raise us up, and I'll get another shot at him. And so they seek to make him king by force. Well, I would suggest that perhaps here's a man who's being successful in military battle. Here's another man who's been successful in a military battle. And perhaps even some of these men said, I'm the one who's going to lead us to victory over Rome. Don't go chasing after those men. Okay? If they say, well, he's here. If they say, we'll read about one man, if time allows, Niger, who they supposed to be dead, and he's hiding, and he comes up after 3 days of hiding and presents himself, I'm still alive. Well, anyway, Menahem, he becomes leader of the sedition for a little while. And believing himself to be invincible, he becomes cruel. Okay? He becomes barbarously cruel against his own people. He kills Ananias the high priest. Really? Okay. He kills Ananias the high priest and Ananias' brother, Hezekiah. Eleazar and his party, he has his own party, who's the son of Ananias. They assault the party of Menahem then and kill Menahem. And again, wars and rumors of wars. See all these things taking place. Then with Menahem dead, a decision is made to leave off besieging the soldiers. And the Roman general who's in Jerusalem, who's been, you know, locked up, trying to keep himself and his soldiers safe, a man by the name of Metellius, he sends word to Eleazar, hey, we'll lay down our arms if you'll just promise security and let us get out. And Eleazar said, well, absolutely. Hey, we love you, Romans. You just lay them down and come on out. And you know what happened when they came out? Wars and rumors of wars. They killed every single one of them. Well, at the same time all this is taking place, there were above 20,000 Jews in Caesarea who were put to death at the command of, who's the governor at the time? Florus. He's doing everything he can. Well, this caused then this slaughter of 20,000. Now it's not just the seditious. You have the whole nation now. The spirit of rebellion is catching fire. And so the whole nation of the Jews rebel, and they start to lay waste to villages in Syria, neighboring cities. In fact, Josephus mentions no less than 16 cities that didn't have any part of anything. But they're in the spirit of rebellion. And he says many of the villages that were about every one of those cities were plundered. And they were plundered by the Jews. And an immense slaughter was made of them who were caught in them. The reaction of the Jews then caused those who were Gentiles, hey, we've got to step up against the Jews. In fact, they step up in opposition to the Jews, even those Jews who were opposed to the rebellion. There was one city by the name of Scythopolis, and they were fearful that the population of the Jews who were there, Jews who had committed, who had stated their loyalty to the Romans, and had taken up arms ready to fight against their fellow Jews. But those of Scythopolis said, well, we're not really sure. Why don't y'all go out? And they had a particular place they wanted them to go, and y'all stay out there for just a period of time. After 2 days, the men of Scythopolis went out and slaughtered every single one of them, man, woman, and child, cut their throats, about 13,000. And then they plundered all the possessions. Well, wars and rumors of wars. In Ascalon, and Ptolemais, and Tyre, and Hippos, and Gadara, Jews were either killed or they were put into prison. Wars and rumors of wars. Well, I've got what? 7 minutes? 17 minutes? No? Okay. Let's talk about... I want to talk about the abomination of desolation. But here's what I really want to talk about. Let's look at Matthew 24:22, because I want to give some explanation of this. 21, then shall be great tribulation. And if you really want to know the tribulation, the misery, the severity of the destruction, the sufferings of the Jews, read books, 5, 6, and 7, the last three books of the Jewish wars, and you'll see the severity of it. But look at 22, except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved, but for the elect's sakes, those days shall be shortened. Now I want to address that. There was a Roman general, Cestius Gallus, who had been in Antioch. Antioch was one of the very few cities that instigated calamities against Rome. Even whenever there was an uprising and all surrounding, they didn't attack the Jewish citizens in their cities. Well, ultimately, Cestius Gallus, Roman general, who'd been in Antioch, he takes the 12th Legion, he takes additional troops from other legions, and he moves southward toward Jerusalem. Ultimately, what have I got, five? Five, okay. Ultimately, he comes they take this place, this place, this place, they put people out. He sends one of his generals with some of the legions up to Galilee, and they put them down. Well, now they come to Jerusalem. And at the time, Jerusalem, it was right. It was ready to take, because here's what had happened. The seditious, the rebellious, they thought, we can't do this. We might as well throw in the towel. And those who were in opposition to the rebellion, they said, hey, let's let the Romans in. Let's just we're ready to let them in. We want peace. Cestius Gallus did not realize the attitude both of the rebellious and of the peaceful. And Josephus suggests, because of false information, false intelligence given by Florus, that Cestius Gallus pulled his troops back from Jerusalem. Now, here's the quote. It happened that Cestius was not conscious either how the besieged despaired of success, that's the rebellious, nor how courageous the people were for him, that is, those who opposed the rebellion, and so he recalled his soldiers without any reason. There was really no reason to do that. Well, this unexplained pulling back of the Roman troops afforded opportunity for those in the city to flee. And if I'm not mistaken, if memory serves, the historian Eusebius said that not a single Christian perished in the destruction of Jerusalem. Why? Well, because of the prophecy of Jesus Christ. I think Hebrews chapter 10, 24 and 25 also has something to do with that. In verses following, the Hebrews writer reminding them to come together to remind one another of the things concerning the Christ. Well, we don't have time to get into other things. I appreciate the opportunity. I love history, especially any type of a history the secular history that can be related and tied into Bible times, especially that history that has to do with ancient Rome. Appreciate the opportunity to speak this hour, and I will I'll try to do it by the end of day to have this information to the email that I need to have it to, so we can get that uploaded, and you'll have access to that. Thank you for your time.